$100,000 or thereabouts. What I was thinking was that you might simply donate $5 to your class fund in lieu of not paying $20, and then for your future officers. You have no officers today.
Right.
So, therefore, you have, you know, some money to do things. One of the other thoughts I had a long time ago is probably another bad thought. It's called these shower thoughts I had in the morning. This shower thought's 30 years old. That's how old this stuff. There's over 100 people in your class. 140 or thereabouts. And if, as you graduate, you donate back to your class fund $100 a year, in 10 years, you will have a sizable pot of money. And you could endow a chair at the university. And then you could have someone come in from someplace else to teach pharmaceuticals or something. Or you pick the instructor you'd like in your place. I don't like the biology. Just now, when I came up with this about 30 years ago, the then president said, but then the students would have control over hiring somebody, even on a one-year basis. So, can't have that. So there are no endowed chairs at Ferris. But you can change it after you get the pot of money and say, here's how you get the pot of money. You get that open to your eyes a little bit. That would be $100 a year. Of course, it's all tax deductible and all that. Just a thought. So anyway, I figured that you pay enough the tuition to get the handout. That's my thought. I'm dying to read, so to speak, because continually the pressure is on the faculty to just simply charge the students. You probably get charged for something like that already. Just a thought. But until then, I'm just a curmudgeon with the administration, and I say no. You already get enough money to do it from the previous. Okay, we were talking the last topic for the exam. We should have a review. We moved the exam back, so we'll have the review. So we moved it to a Tuesday. We'll have the review then the Thursday before the exam. Will be what?
Next Thursday.
Next Thursday, right. Is that all right? Okay. We want to look about how we move children. Part of this is to understand the fact that we can destroy organisms on inanimate objects. We're not doing this with people. Okay. But we are trying to kill organisms on tabletops. Trying to remove the organism from instrumentation that we would be using, so on. And this would be something that you might see for a product that is given out to the public in a sterile form somehow. It might be keeping the area sterile when you are putting together injectables, for example, and drugs. There's an assumption that when someone takes a drug, even if it's an over-the-counter kind of thing, that they open up the bottle and they take it. There's an assumption that they're not going to get sick with a bacterial infection from using that product. Okay? And so that product has to be clean in that sense, sterile, or at least not contaminated. And you can imagine that even if we had something as innate and inert, seemingly inert, as saline salt water, and a patient was getting injection of salt water to maintain body fluids. Nothing special, just simply an IV with body fluids, or IV in their body fluids with saline. But if that saline had been contaminated with a gram-negative organism, and then sterilized, maybe autoclaved, 121 degrees centigrade, 15, 20 minutes, 15 pounds per square inch pressure, and we killed off all the gram-negative organisms in that saline, but we haven't destroyed endotoxin, we just simply killed the organism. We now inject that salt water into a patient, and they go into endotoxic shock and die from salt water that was contaminated with gram-negative organism. So when we make injectables and products, they have to be clean all the way through the system. They can't be just sterilized before they go out the door. Okay. So something to be aware of. In general, we call extraneous agents agents that cause fevers, of which there may be many, that are products of bacteria. We call them pyrogens, which simply means fever-causing agent. So we don't want pyrogens in any kind of medication, obviously. So we need to make certain that things are as they appear. So some of the key definitions would be the difference between sterilization and disinfection, for example. Sterilization means absolutely no organisms at all. No organisms. You cannot be a little bit sterile. The old line is like being a little bit pregnant. You either are or aren't. You either are sterile or you're not sterile. So it has to be 100%. If spores, bacterial spores, which survive extremes of temperature and conditions of acid and so on, if they are there, then obviously you haven't created sterility. So sort of the benchmark of sterility is, does the process destroy spores? If it doesn't, then you've got a problem. Disinfection refers to lowering the level of organisms. Lowering the level of organisms. Not necessarily to zero, but we have a lower threshold of number of organisms. Now, both of these are generally referred to involving inanimate objects. So we don't sterilize patients and we don't disinfect patients. Although I have heard instructors use those things now, but it's not really precise. We don't disinfect the patient. So we have those two general terms. And some examples, and let's take a look at them. There's plenty here, but we'll just sort of pick on some of them. But you should review them and be familiar with them so that when using them, you have an idea of what kind of effectiveness they might have. And if we look on the physical agents, and we're looking at wet sterilization, and you can see that 55 degrees centigrade doesn't kill spores. And wet sterilization, 52 to 30 minutes doesn't kill spores. And 72 minutes or less doesn't kill spores. And 100 degrees boiling doesn't kill spores. Okay. But we do use those. Notice that we have pasteurization, blast pasteurization. A pasteurization will lower the number of organisms. And we pasteurize many different kinds of things. Milk is pasteurized, cheese pasteurized, yogurt is pasteurized, beer is pasteurized. We lower the number of organisms, but not all organisms. So you have pasteurized milk, and you keep it in the refrigerator for 2 or 4 days, and it's fine. If you went on break to Cancun and came back 3 weeks later, so you're gone 2 weeks, and then you say you have the flu for a week, and anyway, so you come back after 3 weeks in Cancun. Or maybe you left a week earlier, something like that. So you've got 3 weeks, and you come back, and the milk that was fine that you left is now all curdled and everything. And what happened was that the lactobacillus, an organism commonly found in the cows, in the milk, and now in the container in the refrigerator, that lactobacillus will ferment lactose and produce lactic acid as the final product of fermentation. Makes some sense, lactic acid. And the lactic acid obviously lowers the pH of the milk and begins to denature some of the milk proteins like casein and so on, and that results in the curdling, that is, making chunks out of what was liquid, which is one of the ways in which we make cheese, sort of curds and whey. Whey is the liquid and the curd is the lumps. Right? So curdling, curds and whey, same idea. And it also tastes sharp tasting, and an odd taste. Tastes sour, as we say. That's simply the taste of lactic acid. So if you have active cultures of yogurt, it has that same lactic acid, because it has among the many organisms that we use to make yogurt, that's one of them. Okay. And so we have that same taste But in one setting, it's, oh, it's charming, this is yogurt from Russia or something like that. And the other case, it's yuck, it's sour milk. It's the same, you know, the cultural thing. But that's all because the organisms were there all along, even though the milk was pasteurized. Flash pasteurization is simply a manufacturing process where we bring the temperature up higher for a minute or so. But you notice it doesn't kill the spore, it won't kill all the organisms. But you can see, you know, it's going to do some damage to some of the proteins, in particular some of the enzymes, and kill off many of the organisms, but not all. If we actually want to have a mechanism that will result in sterilization, we have autoclaving, 121 degrees centigrade, 15 to 20 minutes. Okay? And that's at 15 pounds per square inch pressure. Now that pressure is a variable. This is often a trick question on standardized exams. The pressure is variable. It depends upon the height above sea level that the autoclave is. So the pressure necessary in Denver, the Mile High City, is different than Tel Aviv, which is, I don't know, 160 feet below sea level. So time and temperature, but not pressure. And basically, this is not complicated, it's simple physics. We are heating water in a container that doesn't allow evaporation. That is, it's sealed. And so we have like a pressure cooker, in essence. We call it an autoclave. And by not allowing evaporation, you know, is a cooling process. If you get out of the swimming pool with 95 degree weather, it's still chilly. Evaporation is a cooling process. So the more you boil water at one atmosphere without pressure on it, the more it bubbles and the more it cools. So it evaporates as fast as you heat it, and therefore it never gets above 100 degrees. But if you put a pressure on it and you seal it up, then you boil it, and you try to boil it, but the pressure keeps it so that it's not bubbling away, and therefore it's not evaporating, so the temperature of the water gets above 100 degrees. This is the simple physics. And so that's what's happening in our plane. So that one really kills all kinds of critters. We do destroy the spores. That's an important notice. Also, we can destroy spores and everything else by burning them in a flame or by heating them to 160 degrees. Notice the 160 degrees is for a couple of hours. So if we're going to do something like paper, where we don't want to get it all wet with the autoclave, which is steam, then we can do it something like 160 degrees for an hour or so. And then flame, of course, that's the loop that you do, the inoculating loop. Now that's 1600 degrees for a second or so. Now, the other thing to keep in mind about these times and temperatures is that there's an assumption that we have a clean entity that we're doing. If we have a blood-encrusted instrument of some sort, then that encrusted material will insulate the inner portion of that, and the inner portion may not get to that temperature. It's like cooking meat, and the meat no longer has to be in the meat itself. It's the same idea. It doesn't necessarily get that same ultimate temperature. So dry heat on something that is encrusted kind of material would might have to actually go a lot longer than simply 2 hours. Now cooling is a common way of controlling the growth of organisms. That's why we have refrigerators and freezers and such. But cooling does not kill organisms in any consistent manner. There's no killing of organisms in any consistent manner. Again, it will retard, slow down the growth of organisms. We can actually freeze dry organisms as well. So like freeze-dried coffee. But again, that preserves the organism. And we think under those situations, we actually get spores for those long as 350 years. Obviously, it's an estimate because we haven't been doing it that long. But we do use it to transport microorganisms around the country. We used to do it commonly by the mail, but then you know, people got concerned about bugs in the mail, even if they are freeze-dried. But we can still have them shipped like FedEx and things like that. So basically, we can lyophilize, just like coffee, freeze-dried coffee, we can lyophilize organisms and send them and store them for long periods of time. It's not a killing. And yes, there are some organisms that are killed in the process of ice crystals pounding through the membrane and so on, but not a significant number. I mean, if you lose half the organisms, and then you inoculate, and in an hour you double the organisms, then you really don't block them. Visible light. light. Visible light does have some effect on some endogenous nuts, spores. And visible light has some effect on proteins and nuclear proteins. For example, you can see dimerization of thymine, which is going to increase more when you go to UV light. You get the cross-linking of thymine in the DNA. And those can be used on tabletops. We use them, for example, in a manufacturing setting. We might have a light switch that's got two switches on it, one for the regular light when you're working at that station, and when you turn that off and you flip on the other light, then you have a UV light that then showers that tabletop for the hours that you are not at that workstation. And that's a common way of destroying organisms, although, granted, it's not something to kill all organisms, but significantly reduce the number of organisms at a tabletop in an area maybe where we're doing some manufacturing and making some injectables or something like that. Just keeping the organisms down. Now, hopefully we haven't contaminated the surface, so it should be not needed, but it should anyways. But bear in mind that any shadow that might be there is not going to get any UV light out at all. And I've seen that done commonly. People put the switch on, but then there's something in the way of the light and something blocking or something like that. And the whole tabletop isn't getting full amount of radiation. And of course, we can also use X-radiation, gamma radiation, and so on. And that also will attack with the proteins and so on. Again, it doesn't get through spores all that effectively, so it's not a good way of sterilizing, but it is a way of disinfecting the lower level of organisms. We have radiated food, for example, for long-term storage. The problem with radiation of food is twofold. One, there's a public misconception that somehow it's still glowing in the dark, and when I eat the cabbage that's been radiated, then I'm going to get radiation poisoning or something. That's not going to happen, so there's a perception of that. But it can, depending upon what you're radiating and how much you irradiated it, it can influence flavor and color, texture of food. Okay. So if you are eating lettuce because it's all limp like a cooked noodle, that's not going to taste the same. So some foods can be done more effectively than others in terms of doing this. When we have the various outbreaks of E. coli, that's always something that we see interest in the food industry to irradiate the surfaces of vegetables and that sort of thing. It's probably better in the long run to not get E. coli contamination of the field in the first place and try to catch the horse after it's out of the barn. So it's probably the wrong end of the product process to try to raise food and try to not get E. coli. Human source sewage in the system of fertilization, something like that is a problem. We also have physical methods such as grinding organisms that will sort of crunch them down and burst in cell membranes. Pressure bombs, which is so-called sonication. Sonication is basically we have a metal tip that is vibrating to a very, very high frequency. When you put it into a liquid, that sound vibration transduced through the liquid creates cavitations or low pressure areas, and those low pressure areas then pop the organism's membrane. So sonication can be used. But the problem is that you have to have good penetration of the sound waves through the media. It has to be stir the mix as you do it so that you don't have any spots that you can get the highest vibration amounts and pressure amounts. So it's uneven when done, but it can be used in research settings and such with lyse cells and things like that, the pericellular content. Sonication, that's the same sort of thing that we use. You may see them all and you get your ring clean for free. Okay. And of course, you drop it into the liquid and it falls on a tray and then you drop it down and then sonicate it. Come out and they tell you that now your ring has been cleaned for free, but the dirt that was holding the setting in is now making the setting loose, and for $35 will fix your ring. Filtration, centrifugation, again, not much in the way of killing here, but they can be used to reduce the number of organisms of a certain size. Okay. So, for example, when we want to add an antibiotic for microbial media, so we want to add the antimicrobial agent to the media itself. Well, we can't autoclave that antimicrobial agent. And so we autoclave the media, and then with a syringe with a filter on it, we then filter, sterilize, quote unquote, filter the organism out. But that's a pore size thing. You can do that in a small volume. But any large volume, like trying to filter out the organism for the city water supply or something like that, it's just going to clog so quickly that you can constantly change the filter. So it's really not really effective to do any large size filtration. Now there are a variety of pore sizes available, and of course each one will get rid of most of these various kinds of organisms. You can see that we can actually get down to getting rid of all the bacteria or whatever. But there's generally small volumes that we're going with. The larger pore sizes, you see two tents there, larger pore sizes are used in some ways of commercial products like filtered beer and things of that nature, getting the yeast organism out of the beer in the process. Centrifugation, that will spin down the organisms, and you can see it uses 10,000 G and force of gravity. For an hour, we can then remove many of the organisms, maybe even all of the organisms if all works well. There is a really neat centrifugation which is used commercially as well as for research purposes. And this centrifugation is a continuous centrifugation. So we have a rotor head spinning of a centrifuge that holds gallons or hundreds of gallons or whatever size it is. We have this spinning structure, but in that we have an interesting central point that actually flows in liquid and sucks out from the bottom, from the top, the liquid. So it flows in from the bottom and sucks out from the top. And therefore, it's continuously adding more liquid and taking off the filtered material without ever stopping the centrifuge. Really neat system. Okay. A Russian fellow mentioned it a couple years ago. Really pretty slick. 30 years ago. But nonetheless, it's continuous flow centrifugation is what it's called. And that can be used to, you know, to get rid of the yeast organisms in beer much easier than trying to filter it. But sometimes you have cold filtered beer that you advertise. And they probably cold filter part of the process and centrifuge the rest of it. Doesn't mean they cold filter the whole thing. Okay, but notice that on this first side, we have autoclaving. We have dry heat for a long period of time. And we have flame. Other than that, we have not killed off all organisms. But we don't necessarily have to kill off all organisms through all settings, but that's all we got. And on the opposite side, we have chemical procedures. We can use acids. Okay, various kinds of acids. And you can see that depending on the settings and the length of time, we may or may not get dumped down to the spore. But though they're resistant to acid, it doesn't mean that you cook them in an acid or you use acid in other techniques for long periods of time, you still may be able to get rid of the spores. And they work fairly well, but you see, there's mycobacterium that's sort of resistant in fact that acid does so well. Also, mycobacterium are resistant to the alcohol. In fact, when we take a sputum sample and then, so we're bringing up the sputum, and the sputum sound there. The sputum, not ever bring a sputum. That's really thick. Okay. So how do we get that? So we actually use it in the lab. Well, we thin out the sputum with 1 mmol/cl, and then we centrifuge to get a color, and that's where mycobacterium might be in high concentration. So obviously, mycobacterium are resistant to. 1 mmol/cl. Opticin, which is a detergent, inhibits Streptococcus pneumoniae organisms. And you may recall from your general course in microbiology had that part of the identification of Streptococcus pneumoniae was we drew the organism on a plate and we had a disc called an opticin disc and there was a zone of inhibition around Optigen. Optigen is a mild detergent like a bottle of salt. So it emulsifies fast because it's a bottle of salt. And basically what's happening there is that the membrane and cell wall of streptococcus pneumoniae is unusually susceptible to that effect. Therefore, the other organisms will grow right up to that thing that doesn't bother me at all, whereas streptococcus pneumoniae shows its own inhibition around the oxygen disc, and that's what that means to do. Various kinds of salt, as in salt water, sodium chloride. Of course, sodium chloride has been used to preserve organisms for quite a long time, the salt, pork, and so on, unwanted lysis and so on. So preserving food means killing organisms, and that will happen. And there's various other kinds of salts of various kinds of things that you can do, you can see what you can use. And some are used for disinfectants, and of course, we can use them for fluoride, for fluoride treatments and stuff like that. Now that's preventing tooth decay by a different mechanism. We'll talk about that a little later. And we also have a variety of, again, salts of various compounds. And we can also have various kinds of oxidants, and you can see the halogen system there. We've got iodine, chlorine, of course, chlorine is used in reducing the number of organisms in the water. Okay. It doesn't mean the water is sterile, but most of the organisms are not. But not all organisms are susceptible to chlorine. For example, there's a parasitic organism called Cryptosporidium. And Cryptosporidium, a parasite, has a cyst. And it's not really an egg, but it's a cyst, it's called. And Cryptosporidium spores, or cysts, will persist in the presence of chlorine. This is a problem when we have a large agricultural, mostly cows, fecal material that enters into a public sanitation system. When that happens, if we don't do the proper filtration in those settings, you know, we do filtration with gravel and sand and all that stuff. If we don't do it quite properly and rely heavily on chlorine, that chlorine alone is not sufficient. So then it comes through the drinking water. And if an individual is immunocompromised, leukemia patients, elderly patients, AIDS patients, transplant patients, those patients whose immune system is not working are susceptible of getting cryptosporidium infections, which is going to be a part of a GI tract problem, but it can go systemically as well. In those settings, it can be death-causing. There was such a case about 10 years ago in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and I think someplace around 10, 12 people died of that problem. So anytime we have an excessive amount in terms of volume of sanitation materials that are coming from farms. And this happens increasingly as we have agribusiness creating very large farms. And it didn't happen when we had a farmer that had 100 head of cow and 300 pigs and 500 chickens and that sort of stuff. But when we have thousands and thousands and thousands of animals in one location, then we have a sanitation problem. Of course, we talked about hydrogen peroxide already and how it works. You can see that we have other kinds of oxygen we can use. We use reducing agents, SO2, that can be used as you can see there as a gas. Okay. And that will lower the organisms. That's sometimes used in wine making, so that you'll see sulfites are part of the directly. Label. Some people are allergic to sulfites. It's also used the gas dissolved in a liquid in vegetables and food bars, and then you can go to a restaurant and stuff like that. You see restaurants like the Chinese restaurants and so on, we have this long cafeteria-style bar of food. The reason why it's cheaper there is that what do you think happens when they close for the night? They just cover it up, and what do you think they get the next morning? What was not used the night before? Now, they may take some of the stuff out and sell it. There's a lot of cross-contamination because it just stays there for a long time. And as a result, it's not thrown away every day, and therefore there's potential for growth of bacteria. To prevent that, then they often use a lot of SO2 dissolved in a liquid and sprayed on the salad bar particularly. Some salad bars have that note out there, and many don't. But if you're allergic to sulfites, then that's one place that you must be in contact with your allergen. The other place, of course, would be wine. More so in red wines, but not exclusively in red wines. European wines, if you're in French or Italian or whatever, they have it in it, but they don't put it on the label, so they don't know it. So it's pretty commonly used in the wine industry. Phenols can be used, again, as a gas, and you can see that it has some effects. Detergents, we've got a positive and negative charge detergents, ionic and cationic detergents. You can see how they might be used. Crystal violet, which you use as a stain in the Gram stain. Crystal violet stain in the Gram stain is effective at killing off many organisms, particularly gram-positive organisms, and has historically been used for ear infections. And so they literally pour some crystal violet in your ear, put a cotton plug in your ear to keep it in so it can run down, and the inside of your ear and sometimes the outside of your ear, depending on your neck, was the stain of crystal violet. You see the sulfonamides, which we've already talked about as a compound. I don't know where they're going to work. Heavy metals, and of course, we have the cure from some of the materials that we use in reducing the number of organisms in wound sites and such, you know, for day one. Mercury has been a common one used, and I might just simply add a little comment about it now. The use of mercury has been commonly used as an antimicrobial and antimicrobial agent in vaccines. And the amount of use is relatively a small amount. There is a segment of the population that is concerned about the etiology of the cause of autism, and they have made a temporal linkage between immunizations in the first year of life and the onset of symptoms of autism. It has been commonly refuted in many different studies in the United States and around the world that that's not a cause of autism. But it's one of those things that has gotten into the public psyche, and it's hard to defeat in sort of a non-rational saying. But what they're saying is post hoc ergo proctor. It follows, therefore, it's caused by. You get the immunizations, and then you develop autism. Obviously, the immunization is causative. No. In fact, there's been some interesting studies about brain structure and brain imaging of children in utero who then already are showing signs of autism, then develop observations that we think are observations that are linked to autism later on during the first year of life, indicating that whatever is causing autism, whatever the mechanism there is, it's already begun before the immunizations. So there's no link there that can be drawn in any way. Bureaucratically, what has been done is that there are options made for many of the vaccines to get it without the mercury added, the mercury-free immunizations for influenza. It's just a separate process. And why is the mercury there in the first place? Is to reduce the possibility of getting a bacterial infection when you get the immunization. Yes?
I was actually reading about the flu vaccine last night. Just out of curiosity, I read the monograph, and I think it's got less than 20 micrograms of mercury in the whole vaccine.
Yeah, if you have a filling, you're leaking a whole lot more than that in your body than the other fillings.
Yeah.
The amalgam often contains mercury. But, you know, this is not a rational process, and it's a very scary thing for the couples that have children with autism, and, you know, there's a lot of concern about it. Until there is a definitive causation, whatever that might be, genetic links, or whether there are environmental links, or, you know, until we know what it is, we cannot definitively say that it's not this. We just simply say, well, there's no mechanism for this. no rational reason to believe it's this, other than post hoc ergo properly. So you'll hear some discussions about that. Occasionally, it gets in the brain of legislators, and they want to create rules and blah, 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 you know, not based on rational, not science, but based on quote-unquote ergo proper rules. So we have heavy metals that we can use. Ethylene oxide. Now, ethylene oxide is a very good compound. It's a gas sterilization agent, and ethylene oxide is effective at destroying spores and bacterial cells. And so ethylene oxide is commonly used in hospital settings to sterilize plastics. Now, plastics have an economic advantage over glass when used for pipettes and syringes and thermometers and all kinds of things, because they're disposable, and we don't have to then autoclave them and reuse them. Of course, you can't autoclave plastic very easily, so it's a big problem. So basically, you manufacture plastics, whether it be a pipette or the petri dishes that you use in the lab are all plastic, and they're in a plastic container. So we have a plastic entity in a plastic bag. The gas will penetrate the plastic bag and the petri dish or the syringe or the pipette, and then destroy all the organisms. And basically, we have a chamber much like an autoclave. We evacuate the air, we pump in the ethylene oxide, it sits there for a period of time, we evacuate back out the ethylene oxide, and we put in air into the chamber. It's very analogous to an autoclave. So ethylene oxide is another comparable to autoclaving, and it's particularly good for plastic and paper and things that you don't want to get wet. Now, formaldehyde, of course, can be used as a gas. Metals can be used in a liquid, and we can dissolve the gas in a liquid kind of thing. That has some toxic effects on people's skin and everything else. It's not something we want to breathe in or anything like that, but it's a possibility as well. Going down, skipping down, we have, of course, mustard gases and so on, which are used as a chemical weapon in World War I. Obviously, these are toxic compounds that expose the skin and mucous membrane. Can be used in certain settings, not commonly though. Organic solvents, you notice that the organic solvents there are 50 to 70%. So ethanol, isopropanol, and various alcohols and so on, 50 to 70%. And why is it 50 to 70%?
So you can have some water.
Yeah, so it's because it's then 50 to 30% water. And we need the water in there to maintain that amazing process. And you can see that it's going to be working in some. It does work in long term on spores, but we have to do it for a long time. So it's a little dubious when we say it works on spores. Okay. If you rub alcohol in someone's skin and then inject them, you're really not doing a whole lot except cleaning it up a little bit. We usually use something like povidone iodine. Iodine, which is sort of a rusty kind of color, that is a little more effective in terms of what it kills in the first few minutes or the first few seconds. So we don't generally wipe out alcohol. We can use coconut iodine on the skin before injection. Okay, so that's just a little background. But you notice that most of the things that we use with an understanding that it's not sterilization. It's not killing off the spores. Well, we take that into consideration when we handle that problem. We don't expect food to be sterilized, although we don't expect it to have high levels of work in the mice. Use what we talked about, and we're coming into a more clinical setting that is more oriented and so on. The first topic is a broad one, but it's an important one, and that is post-parasite relationships or interactions. And in this setting, the patient or the human is a host, and the parasite is the microorganism. So that would be by host and parasite. And the reason why we want to discuss that is obviously if we're having a patient that's a host infected with the organism. Just as the H1N1 is running through the community, but not everybody has got it, and not everybody's dying from it, but some people will die from it. So how is it that we have some people infected, some people not, some people getting infected and recovering in 4 days, I mean most people, and some people having a long-term problem and even dying from it? Why? And that has to do with what the concept of dynamic balance. In dynamic balance, it's sort of like a seesaw or teeter-totter. On one side, we have the virulence of the organism, and on the other side, we have the defense of the host. These two come together, and depending upon which way it teeters and totters, which way it falls, if the patient's immune system is weak, then you have disease. If the patient's immune system is strong and the virulence structures are weaker, then you have no disease. So with any kind of interaction between the human species and the microbial species, there's a balancing act. So we don't say that organism X always causes disease and death and so on. So we don't say organism is always a pathogen. It may be a pathogen. It may be an organism that causes disease. It depends. Likewise, we have patients whose immune systems are weaker than everyone else, these immune-compromised patients. The immune-compromised patient is at risk for more diseases than the average person. This is sort of understood from common observation. So we have this balancing. And it's a moment-by-moment kind of thing. A variety of things can make you more or less susceptible, even if you were in so-called normal range. So we have immunocompromised individuals. Let's for a moment define some of them. Again, the immune system we'll talk more specifically. Between the ages of 3 months and 5 years of age, your immune system is still developing. So you are immunocompromised, more so at 3 months than at five, but you don't come on with a full immune system until about 5 years of age. And why do we not begin at birth? Well, what happens is that during the pregnancy, your mother is providing strong amounts of antibody protection across the placenta. So that at the time of birth, you have about 100% of the maternal immunoglobulin G, that's one of your antibodies. Immunoglobulin is a fancy word for antibody. Immunoglobulin, the globular molecule. This immunoglobulin, or antibody, has many varieties, or classes. And one of those classes is immunoglobulin G, or IgG. Capital I, little g, capital G, IgG. So, immunoglobulin G is found in the bloodstream of the mother, crosses the placenta, the baby is born with the mother's antibody. The half-life of IgG is about 30 days, it's a little less than 30 days, but 20-some days to 30 days. So that means that every month after birth, the level of protective antibody diminishes by one half. So by 3 months, we're now down 1/8, if we do this properly, right? One half, 1/4, 1/8. We go below 1/8, it's not significantly protected. Meanwhile, back at the ranch with the baby's own immune system, under normal circumstances, it's just getting cranked up. So in the first 3 months, it's not doing much of its own. So all of a sudden, the mother's antibody is gone, and the baby's is just coming online, very low levels, and therefore the baby's at highest risk. So what age do you think? At birth, at 4 months, or at 5 years, do you think a baby is at greatest risk of getting bacterial meningitis? It's going to be at that 4 month period of time. Right? And so if you look at the incidence of meningitis in children, or whatever disease you want to look at, isn't highest at birth, it's highest about 3 months and 4 months and so on. And then it declines as the baby's immune system correspondingly increases. Makes sense. Okay. We don't like to immunize children too young because their immune system is not going to respond. So we hear about age ranges of other immunizations and so on, and a lot of them want age one and so on. And it's basically because of that process. Another age range, of course, would be the elderly, whatever that age might be. Okay, it's your biological age, not your chronological age. But certainly people after the age of 50, their immune systems get gradually less and less and less. But where do they break that protective line? We arbitrarily say 60 to 65. And we put you over the age of 65. Increasingly, you are in risk categories. What will amplify that will be anything else that's going on in your lifestyle at that time. If you're a diabetic, clearly we're going to lower that age a little bit. If you have pulmonary problems, the heart is not working properly, we have vascular congestion relative to the lung circulation of the heart, we have fluid buildup around the heart, we have fluid buildup around the lungs, all of those kinds of things exacerbate the immune function and increase the risk. So patients that have histories of heart problems, even though they're only 50, are people that are at risk. A diabetic who is 50 is at a greater risk than a non-diabetic person that doesn't have anything else going on with them, and they may be 70-something. So we can't really put an actual upper end age. It a lot depends on other circumstances. And then, of course, we have people who are immunocompromised because we're treating with immunosuppressive drugs because of the kind of cancer or leukemia they may have. So we artificially, through the administration of drugs, can lower the person's immune response if their immune response is not being helpful for them, if they have cancer or something. A person who's got a transplant, and their body may reject that transplant, so we suppress their immune response. Patients that have, so we have leukemia patients and lymphoma patients, lymphoma is dealing with the cells of the immune system, like the lymph node. Leukemia is dealing with cells in the bloodstream. But we also have AIDS patients and that sort of thing. Okay. And again, there's a spectrum there. But any of those things that put a person at risk, because we know that their immune system is working, means that they are at risk for infections when other people would not be at risk for infections, from an organism that would typically cause disease. So that pathogen range, we know that H1N1 causes disease, but not everybody gets it. This is why. We now know who we need to protect then, who needs the immunization more than other people, and so on. In addition, there are organisms that don't generally cause infections in people at all. Unlike H1N1, when, sometimes it always helps people come down with diseases, there are some organisms that really don't cause human disease typically at all. But in these patients, these immunocompromised patients, they do cause problems. We call this category of organism opportunistic pathogen. It's taking advantage of the fact that the patient is in a weakened condition. So we have pathogens in which you, general population, can get them to one degree or another and usually not fatal and so on. And then we have the opportunistic pathogen, one that typically doesn't cause a problem. And if it does cause a problem, then usually the person is immunocompromised. We can use this understanding if we find a patient coming down with an infection from an organism that's not typically a pathogen. We don't simply just treat that particular kind of problem and say, well, we'll be fine. No, we think about that a little bit and say, well, this shouldn't happen. Let's pull on the string a little bit. Let's try to find more about this patient because we think that they're immunocompromised. There's some other reason going on in their life that they came down with that. For example, reason might be they're going to be not immunocompromised, but they may be introducing the organism to a body site that's not normal. For example, Staph aureus. Okay, a Staph aureus organism can cause pneumonia if we put it into the lungs, but we don't generally put it into the lungs. Okay. Staph organisms are often found in your nose, so on. What happens is if a person is vomiting a lot and they tend to aspirate their vomits, then they're rinsing out their upper urinary. They got sick when they drank too much beer, and it comes out their nose and everything else that's flowing out the toilet. That rinsing out of the upper respiratory tract, in some patients, if they're not well conscious, they aspirate that vomit and get it into their lungs, then carrying in the organisms from their upper respiratory tract into the lungs. So a person coming down with Staph aureus pneumonia will say, gee, that's really strange. So we can treat that pneumonia, but we want to know how I got there. And so now we're suspicious that maybe a drug user of some sort. And we need to know more about the patient. It's that kind of information. So organisms that cause infections that don't typically cause infections, we need to know why that happened. Okay, so we can get to the underlying cause of it. So this is all with this dynamic balance idea. We have a pathogen. We don't like to use the word pathogen, meaning this organism always causes disease, because we know that's not true. It doesn't always cause disease. Often maybe. Commonly, maybe, but not always. Not everybody will come down with the flu, even though this organism is possible with the flu. H1N1. On the other hand, we have the other extreme. We don't say, this organism never causes disease. On my skin, I have Staphylococcus epidermidis. It's called epidermidis because it's on the skin. This organism, I have it on my skin, you have it on everybody's skin. Doesn't cause disease. Well, yes, it can. It can cause disease. For example, if we have an indwelling catheter and we get the organism from the skin into the bloodstream. Oh, well, in that case, it causes disease. So sometimes it's the location of the organism that leads to an increased likelihood of it causing a problem. So normally it doesn't, but we don't like to use the word always pathogen or never pathogen. Non-pathogens cause disease all the time in an appropriate patient and appropriate condition. So we don't want to get into the habit of thinking a certain organism isolated from the patient doesn't mean anything. Because it may. We have to put it in the context of what's going on in that patient. Are they in a normal immune system or not? Are they a 5-month-old child or are they a 35-year-old person with no problems? Are they a 93-year-old person whose immune system is collapsing? Just got to know more about that organism we just found in the bloodstream. It may be nothing at all. It may be the culprit we're looking for. Types of infection, we have community-acquired infection and nosocomial infection. Nosocomial, of course, hospital-acquired infections, more often associated with patients that have something else wrong with them already, because that's why they're in the hospital. So a hospital worker, the pharmacist, the doctor, the nurse, the custodian, the people sitting in the floor, those are not considered to be, when they get infections, we're not taking them as being weakened. But we're talking about a typical patient coming down with an infection, and that's a nosocomial infection, and that's a hospital-acquired infection. And that hospital-acquired infection often is associated with increased antimicrobial resistance because the organism has been selected for resistance by being in the environment of the hospital. So they're generally hard to treat. Hard to treat because the bug doesn't respond to as many drugs, and hard to treat because we're dealing with a patient that's got their own problems to begin with. We have community-acquired infections, and these are the ones that people walk in from the street into the hospital with. Community-acquired. Okay. And they are generally easier to treat because the patients are otherwise healthier, and the organism has been selected for resistance. Now, occasionally, one of the bugs from the community, or from the hospital, sneaks out into the community. And we're seeing this with methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, or MRSA. Now, methicillin resistance, we mentioned, methicillin-resistant Staph aureus is resistant to more things than simply methicillin. Okay. And so depending upon where we acquired this, if we acquired this a wound infection in a hospital, so someone broke their leg and they acquired it, it was a compound fracture, it required surgery, and in that process they were exposed to the organism. That's going to be harder to treat. That particular variety of MRSA, methicillin-resistant F. aureus, is going to have more than simply methicillin, and it's going to be harder to find a drug to work on it. We have vancomycin, for example, which often backed up. There are others. Versus a community-acquired variety, which is a common one, you might see a football player. Artificial turf is great for spectators. It makes the game of football faster because they're running on carpet. And sometimes you've ever walked on an artificial turf. It's basically like this carpet on cement. Okay? So it has very little give to it. And it's basically on cement or it's on asphalt or something like that. And you have this carpet on it. Okay. So when you fall on it, you get a really nasty brush burn. So you get a burn. It rips away the skin. And so you'll see players with knee pads and elbow pads and things like that to protect them against the rug burn kind of situation. It's like a road rash if you lay down and fight on the road at 50 miles an hour. Okay. If you lay down and fight on the road at 100 miles an hour, you don't worry about changing the road, you didn't leave. But if you ride a bicycle or a motorcycle and lay it down, you get really nasty. You can get like, from your heels to your head. You can take off all the skin and hair. And you know. I always think about that when I see people with flip-flops on their motorcycles, with shorts on and flip-flops, no helmet, catching bugs. In Buffalo, when I went to the grad school there, and they called it the donor cycles, because they were, we were into these, you know, matching for tissue type was down the road there, and they would be good people to donate organs, because they're usually young people, their head's gone and messed up and so on, but their lungs and kidney are good still. Donor cycles. And then they put in a helmet law, and then we worked on basically people that were riding the back of a pickup truck. They were also good too. And in fact, the pickup truck, obviously, you just go, shh, and then cross it off to get one. There's a good head injuries as well. So those are donors as well. Anyway, we have donor wagons, we call those. But you have a variety of different settings. So we have football players coming down with this rug burn, and it often gets infected with MRSA. And we've had it at Ferris, we've had it at many different places, many different athletes who work and play, that is work, practice, and play, on this rug. We call artificial turf. Okay. We have the artificial turf here, in part because a couple of years ago, the Ferris football team was really, really good, and they made the championship round and so on and so. And the board of trustees were standing in the cold, watching this game in the mud, and they didn't like that. So they built themselves, as we did in the football, they had a nice little warm place that they could sit out there and have tea and beer and wine and whatever, and they could sit and watch the game away from the crowd and eat and so on. And they can see the game on artificial turf. So anyway, so you see this MRSA occurring in athletes in high school and so on, and that's coming out of the hospital acquired system. It's not as resistant, but it is still resistant. So it's more than the normal Staph aureus. It is a methicillin-resistant variety, but there's a range of those varieties. Unfortunately, the community-acquired MRSA is more easily treatable. Now, occasionally, again, hysteria and all that will come about, and a school district will close down because of a MRSA epidemic in their school district, and they will hire people to come in and clean the desks and tables and so on. Not necessary. Basically, all we need to do is make sure that that wound is covered properly, and it's not going to creep out and jump out and get you. So all we need to do is bandage it up and have it covered. That's not hard for the people to figure out. If it's covered, it's okay. And of course, if you have a third grader, they pull it off and make sure that they get it back on again. It's really not all it takes. It's not going to spread around as magically as some people think. So we do have some creep from nosocomial infecting selective resistant organisms into the community. Of course, that's not a good thing. I don't mean to put down MRSA in the community, but it's easier to treat. But also realize there's a range of resistances. A associated with the so-called methicillin resistance that worries. Many other antimicrobial agents could be in that mixture of resistance. So one little plot for you, a little puzzle for you. Let's say we have someone who has tuberculosis. And we know that the organism forms the granuloma, which is an acid fast organism. And inside the granuloma is the organism. So let's say we have John J. Brown. John J. Brown came from England, and as a child he was exposed, and he has the organism in a granuloma, and he has the organism in his body for 35 years. He got his 10, so now he's 45. So we have a 45-year-old person that has the organism in the body. We also have another person, Susie Q, and Susie Q's Susie Q Jones, is also 45 years old, but just acquired the organism. Just got it. They both have tuberculosis. One has had it for 35 years, one just got it. Which one is going to be more likely to be a problem treating? We're just going to begin treatment on each of them now. So which one is more difficult to treat? The one that's been inside the guy's body for 35 years, or the one that's been out in the problems and out in the bowel and like other people's bodies for 35 years? Yes. Exactly. Okay. We see this on a daily basis. So people that have had the organism in their body for long periods of time, untreated, which is not a good thing, but it makes it easier to treat that isolate. Whereas the other isolate has been selected for resistance for 35 years and now gets in the patient. So the newly acquired variety is going to be more likely to be resistant than the one that's been in a patient's body in an untreated setting. It's the selection process. We know about various factors. We know some bacteria. We know about capsules and AVs causing pneumonia and meningitis. We know that pili alone is associated with Neisseria gonorrhoeae. Pili and flagella are associated with what? Urinary tract infection. And we also have toxins. We know a little bit about endotoxin because we know that's part of gram what? Negative cell wall, lipid A. Remember the lipid polysaccharide layer and lipid A in particular. So we have endo meaning inside and exo meaning secreted. So we have two kinds of toxins with a different array of characteristics. So we're going to compare these two. Boy, it sounds like a test question to me, but what do I know? So we're going to compare exotoxins and endotoxins. So the table might be helpful. Here we have exotoxins. They're secreted from living cells. Right away, we remember that endotoxin is released from endothelial cells, so right away, we get a difference there. It also tells us that once you have the release of an exotoxin, more is to come. If the organism is alive and growing and producing more toxin all the time. So that's significant, the fact that it's being secreted from the living cells. The more cells you got, the more toxin you get. It's found in both gram-positive and gram-negative organisms. Remember, of course, endotoxin will be only gram-negative. That means gram-negative organisms can have both exotoxins and endotoxins. I usually didn't say that last line, and I would ask that on the test question. I would tell everybody, endotoxins, only gram-negative, exotoxins, gram-positive, and gram-negative. And then on the test, they'd say, okay, put a gram positive, gram negative organism, and a both. People would say, oh no, it only has endotoxin. It's hard to put those two pieces together. So now I'll make the second statement. Yes, a gram negative organism can have both exotoxin and endotoxin. Exotoxins are made of proteins, as opposed to lipid A in the endotoxin world. So proteins can be injured. That is, we can heat them up or chemically treat them and then result in an altered form of that protein, a denatured protein. That denatured protein is called a toxoid. And the really neat thing about toxoids are that we can immunize a patient with that altered protein, non-poisonous toxoid, no longer affected as a toxin. Yet it will stimulate an immune response, for example, an antibody, that will bind to the toxoid and bind to a fully active toxin. That's pretty slick. So that means we have an immunizing agent. We can give you the toxoid, you'll produce an antibody to the toxoid, but also an antibody to the fully functional exotoxin. So we have a protective antitoxin. An antibody to a toxin is an antitoxin. They are target cell specific. We have a variety of exotoxins. I'll give you a litany of a few, and we'll talk more as we go through specific diseases. But they have a specific target. They stop protein synthesis. They stop nerve transmission. You know, whatever they might do. But it's a very, very specific kind of thing. As opposed to endotoxin, which gave us a wide variety of effects, which is triggered a endotoxin level response. So endotoxin triggers your immune response to overreaction. Little or no fever. Again, one of the cytokines triggered by endotoxin was one that triggered fever. So that's what gave you fever. So little or no fever here. Plasmid related. So that means a couple of things. Plasmid related means that not all genus and species of a particular organism are going to have the ability to produce a toxin. It's not part of the genomic information. It's an expedited feature. Oh, you bought the light package or the tow package or the truck or whatever. Okay? You paid extra for a little stripe, a sport package. Whatever it might be, that's extra, not the basic model. So the plasmid is extra, not all organisms have it. It also means that we can have gradations of response depending on how many plasmids that particular isolate has. If you have a lot of plasmids producing a lot of exotoxin, or a few plasmids producing less. And finally, it also indicates how it might be spread. If that plasmid is a self-replicating plasmid, we know it can be spread by HFR and it can be spread by F prime. Which we know have different complications. F prime is what they give, keep on giving, whereas HFR simply results in that recipient cell being inverted and having that possibility of a toxin production. If it's on a non-self-replicating plasmid, then it's usually spread by transduction. Well, virus is involved, vector virus is involved. So the fact that it's plasmid-related tells us some things. Endotoxin, which we already know, part of the cell wall, leads to the death of the organism. Just a minor correction there. There is a little leakage when the cell is making itself wall. So when the cell is growing, there's a little leakage, but the vast majority. So by little leakage, you're meant for saying 99% of it produced upon the death of the cell. But there's a little bit that's leaked out on the line of the cell. There's a little bit there. It's being leaked out as part of the making of the cell. Sort of like the building and construction site, and there's bits and pieces of broken wall as a building the wall, and different bricks and some cement laying around, and some wood and so on. Same sort of idea. When we're making cell wall, there are some bits and pieces of the lipopolysaccharides that are spun off into the media, and that can result in a minor release, a minor effect. Gram-negative only. LPS layer of the day, not denatured, it's a lipid. Okay? When you heat up a lipid, you get a hot lipid. When you cool it down, you get a cool lipid. It's still there. Bacon grease. You can reuse it again and again and again. Okay? Because it's a lipid. An egg, you fry once, it's done. Denatured by heat. A protein egg is denatured by heat. A lipid is not. So use your common sense and you make some conclusions from that. So it's not denatured. So that means there's no toxoid possible. We can't heat up lipid A and inject it in the patient, expecting anything other than the death of the patient. No antitoxin. The protective response is not an antibody response. Remember, this is going to be a cytokine effect. No specific target. Because what's happening is we have an enhanced immune response. So lipid A triggers low molecular weight compounds called cytokines to be released from macrophage and to be released from lymphocytes, and they are then going to have their effects around the body. So, for example, interleukin-1, IL-1, interleukin-1, is one of the many that are being released. Interleukin-1 binds to the blood vessel lining, causing the leakiness that we associate with the fluid loss into the tissue, resulting in blood volume dropping and blood pressure dropping, which we said has impacts, negative impacts, on heart pumping as a pump, heart structure as a pump, which means fluid does build up around the heart, and very large arterial sac. The exchange between the heart and lungs is interfered with, the fluid building up in the pleural cavity. All of this is not good for the patient, making breathing and heart pumping impaired. The patient then also has loss of electrolytes, and the fluid left, cells are left behind, red blood cells. Red blood cells are in a smaller volume, so they're more concentrated, therefore blood is thicker, viscosity is increased. But we also have loss of electrolytes, and that's going to impact kidney function, which results in kidney failure and death. We also indicated interleukin 1 will bind to the hypothalamus, and hypothalamus then, of course, is the regulating site for body temperature, among other things, and we just simply change the set point by changing the thermostat. So basically, we change that set point, and the body is told that it's cold now, and that your body temperature should be 39 degrees centigrade instead of 37. So then the body does all the things appropriate, holding in heat, and then you build up more heat, and you get a fever. So it's a derived fever. It's not the endotoxin somehow itself increases your body temperature, but its effect on the body is it increases fever. Increases your body temperature. So if we inject the patient, so again, as I mentioned earlier, if we have an injectable linked with a saline, and even if there's no living organisms in it, but there was once gram-negative organism there, and we killed the gram-negative organism, but now in that saline we have lipid A, and we can inject that and trigger fevers and all these different problems in the patient. And again, interleukin 1 is only one of a whole series of cell signals or cytokines, interleukins, there's many of them, that are being activated when lipid A does its thing. Of course, it produces the fever. It's genomic related. All gram-negative organisms have it, part of how they make a cell wall. I'll give you some examples of exotoxins. Carinibacterium diphtheriae in a lysogenic relationship with betaphage. And the bacteriophage, betaphage, specific name of the bacteriophage, red phage. So betaphage has a toxin that disrupts the elongation factor number 2, which is essential for protein synthesis in eukaryotic cells. So a patient with diphtheria is having problems with protein synthesis in their cell. So the derived problem is it's a bacterial virus inside a bacterial cell that causes the problem, but it's an exotoxin. We also have the exotoxin associated with Clostridia tetani, that is tetanus, which causes spasms, contraction of the nervous system and the muscles. Contraction. We can also have Clostridia botulinum, the organism that causes botulism. And this sort of disconnects the nerve signal. And as a result, we have a flaccid paralysis, a weakness seen initially because people can't control their eyelids. Their eyelids are drooping. It takes a little bit of muscle control to keep their eyelids up. Okay. Ultimately, they'll be completely shot, but major muscles are still working. But the minor ones have, so we see their eyes drooping, and we see them drooling. They can't hold their lip up, so they're drooling. Those are signs that would be associated with botulism. And ultimately, if you have cardiac arrest, respiratory arrest, and the patient dies. It begins small. So that's called a flaccid paralysis. So we had a variety of different kinds of toxins. And one of the characteristics of this intoxication is that it can result in a rather rapidly fulminating disease course, meaning once we get the organism in our body growing, it's going to produce more and more of this toxin in a relatively short period of time. And from the early symptoms to death can be a relatively short period of time. It could be a matter of hours, or maybe a matter of a few days. Legionella pneumophila, Legionnaire's disease, Legionella pneumophila, an organism that we'll talk about that invades the respiratory tract, produces the toxin, and can result in a rapidly fulminating disease course in 4 or 5 days you're dead. And compared to a typical bacterial pneumonia, you know, it takes 2 weeks to die, or longer, you can die of the actual infection. More rapidly fulminating disease course. Again, genomic related tells us how it can be spread. It can be spread basically by the cell's body because it's part of the genome. So the organism, all gram-negative organisms have it. Anytime we have a gram-negative organism in the bloodstream, we have a possibility of endotoxic shock. If the organism is not in the bloodstream, let's say a gram-negative organism in a wound site, or a gram-negative organism in the bladder or urinary system that's not exposed directly to the bloodstream, then it's not going to cause endotoxic shock. But once the organism gets in the bloodstream, we have a gram-negative septicemia, meaning increasing numbers of gram-negative organisms in the bloodstream, then we have a problem. Any gram-negative organism, and of course there are dozens of gram-negative organisms that might find a way in the bloodstream. Anytime we have any gram-negative organism in the bloodstream, we have the possibility of endotoxic shock. The first area that we want to look at, we'll be looking at this collection of microorganisms, bacteria, and yeast organisms, and viral organisms, and fungal organisms, and a few parasitic organisms. We do it by body size. Because basically, that's how the patient comes to the attention of the medical authority. They have a body size problem. They have a cough. They have a respiratory tract problem. They have a GI tract problem, they have a central nervous system problem, they have some kind of body system that's not working. And from that, we have to figure out what is it that's causing the problem. Classically, microbiology has been taught by this genus and then that genus and then this genus and then that genus. It's a classification system. But that, of course, is then the user of that information to reassemble it to find out what might be causing the person's pneumonia. This way we're giving you that already done. So we're talking about different genera, different kinds of organisms, but we're talking about a common target. And so if we look at the respiratory tract, and we have the upper and lower respiratory tract. So let's take a look at the upper respiratory tract first. In terms of body parts, we're talking about the larynx and the back of the throat, pharynx. Oral cavity, we'll mention a little bit about oral cavity. Sort of a separate category there. Nasal passages, and not directly mentioned there, but also should be included, would be the sinuses. And as we'll see, there's a common link, basically because of anatomy, a common link between the organisms that cause upper respiratory tract infection and organisms that cause eye infection. So we have this upper part of the body. We also have the ear, the middle ear, that causes earaches. The major earache, of course, is otitis media. Otitis meaning ear, media meaning middle, so we have otitis media. So we have the ears, the eustachian tube, the throat, we have the sinuses, we have the eyes, all of this in this upper respiratory tract. And then moving down a little bit into the back of the throat, pharynx, and the larynx. This is the area we're looking at. One thing to keep in mind is that organisms in this upper respiratory tract typically don't cause problems in the lower respiratory tract. Now, some do,
particularly if the person's immunocompromised, if there's something else going on. But just because you have Streptococcus pneumoniae as an eye infection causing pink eye, or Streptococcus pneumoniae causing an earache or a sore throat, or just simply growing in your throat causing no really irritation at all, does not put you at risk of getting Streptococcus pneumoniae and pneumonia. During periods of epidemics of pneumonia in the community, in the hospital setting, hospital workers, as you may be at one point in time, hospital workers can carry the organism in their throat, not having any disease, as much as 90% of the time during the epidemic. And they are not any particular risk of getting pneumonia. Because we have a very good protection system, as we'll talk about, so called innate. Innate immune system, cilia, mucus, and diaphragm, and stuff, coughing and sneezing, all that keeping things out of the lungs. Some of the organisms that we'll be talking about in this area, Staphylococcus aureus, are commonly found in the upper respiratory tract and their nasal passages, rarely caused in the lung. And they gave you an example today of one of the rare situations, that is someone who aspirates vomit. And basically, they're rinsing out the upper respiratory tract and aspirating and getting it into the lungs. But that would be unusual. Doesn't mean it never can happen, but when it happens, there's something else going on. Neisseria meningitidis, we'll talk about strep pyogenes, of course, the organism causes strep throat, among other things. Corynebacterium diphtheriae can be lodged there as well, and Haemophilus influenzae. Haemophilus influenzae is one of the organisms that we can also see down in the lungs under the right conditions. Beginning here in the middle ear, let's take a look at this middle ear and a little map here. Here we have the eustachian tube. See the pharynx here. So we basically have this angle. See this angle? This is the middle ear area. Here's the middle ear. The exterior ear, obviously. We have this angle. And then we have this angle. Now in the drawing, you see it, you can see that in the drawing here, that we have something that is causing a problem here. Now that something could be a mild viral infection. Influenza can do this. But mild viral infection results in some irritation into this area. And irritation results in swelling, which then causes a constriction here. See. Of course, constriction means we don't have the flow that we would normally have, and we have fluid building up in here. So we have a viral problem here, and it could be a minor one. And that results in fluid buildup. Now that fluid buildup causes pain here. You might even see this bulge out. So basically, we have a pressure problem. It's as simple as that. It's simple physics. If you have a container of Coke or something, and there's just a one over there, and you open up one, maybe a beer, you know, and then you pour it, does it go, the blood flows, comes out, and it sucks in air and goes out, it sucks in air and goes out, it sucks in air. We have to have this balance of pressure, otherwise something comes out. If we had a larger, like a V8 juice can, something like that, and we open up with an old-fashioned little thing to put a little triangle on, we open up both ends, the flip it. Because it's sucking in air at the top one, and liquid is coming out. So if you're pouring a Coke or a beer, if you hold it not so steep, it'll come out easy because it allows the air to go in the same hole. But if you hold it upside down, it doesn't want to come out at all. It's the same idea. We have a pressure problem here. So what begins with a viral infection in the throat and the eustachian tube, a very minor one, maybe not even noticed by the patient. So we're not talking about flu or anything like that. It's a little sore throat, nothing major.
resulted in closing down these patients who result in building up the fluid. If this is a child between the ages of, magically, between about 3 months and 5 years of age, interesting age range there. If it's in that age range, then we're allowed to get a viral infection there, and the kid has an earache, otitis media. It's 4 o'clock in the morning, and the kid is screaming bloody murder, and you take the kid to the doctor. And basically what happens is the patient wants treatment. The patient wants antibiotics because the patient has already, the parents, have already diagnosed their daughter or their son as having a bacterial infection. And they want an antibiotic. Have we mentioned antibiotics? Have we mentioned bacterial? No. We mentioned a viral infection down here in the extension tubes, and we got fluid below here. No bacteria. 4 o'clock in the morning. So what's happening is that physicians would often give antibiotics to these children. And of course, it's doing no good. Except it is selected for resistance among their normal flora. And when we see these children who were treated for earaches as a child, we see them as an early teenager, the ability to treat bacterial infections in them is harder, statistically you can demonstrate this, harder because they have more antibiotic resistance. Because the normal flora is now spreading that resistance that they were selected for in the first 5 years of life, and now spreading that to the bacteria that they're getting in the next years of their life. So by simply treating, and this is one of the spin-offs of the use of Flumist, which is a inhalation kind of spray, you can do it a couple of ways, inhale it and just squirt it on up your nose and all that. But anyway, we have this way of a non-needle kind of delivery, and we did this in clinical trials in Texas. And a spin-off of that was, we realized that these children had fewer earaches, and therefore they were treated, or should we say, mistreated with antibiotics less than the other kids, and therefore when they had infections later in life, they were easier to treat. Okay. And again, this was not a major infection of influenza. It was nothing that they would have gone to treat alone, but it set up this fluid buildup. So what we can do is we can maybe use a little antihistamine, depending upon the age of the child, to dehydrate slightly. The very young children, we have to be careful about dehydration, but a little older range, we can do it. The other, which would then get rid of that fluid, which is causing the problem. Now, if that fluid stays there for 5 days or a week or 10 days, then that fluid, the longer it's sterile fluid, meaning no bacteria, and we can have the virus and virus in it, but we now can start having that as media for the growth of bacteria. So you can get a bacterial infection, ultimately, but not at 4 o'clock in the morning, not the first, just have a boom, no. No. It's going to have a chronic situation. You've had this now for a couple of weeks or 10 days or longer. So this can be fluid, it can be a media source for bacteria growth, but it's not the initial cause, and it's not what you're seeing initially. So clearly, the first several days, it's not bacteria at all. So dehydrate, can do a little bit, but really what we have a problem here is the drainage. It's compounded by this little bit of anatomy. Remember we said that it starts off, it looks like this, this line here. Well, when you're first born, it's going to be less of an angle because your head changes a little bit. In some kids, it's a neutral angle, flat almost. In other kids, it's even slightly negative. And as you go from birth to about 7 years of age, it moves in this direction. Can you see that? Very. Have this angle, and what we see is the movement either negative or neutral all the way down to here. So when do we see most earaches? Under the age of about 7. After age of about 7, we've got larger eustachian tube, and the angle is better. so it drains better. Remember, our problems is a plumbing problem created by a viral infection away from the ear down the eustachian tube. So you can still get those eustachian tube problems. You pop your ears, you know, pop in your ear kind of thing. Equalizing the pressure there, chewing gum in an airplane. But we have a problem with these younger children. So what we can do is we can put tubes in their ears. And the tube in the ear, what we're seeing here is this. And that's right there. So the tube in the ear is really to balance the pressure off. It's that other spot that we opened up that can of the aid. So now we have better drainage behind the eardrum, that membrane. And it'll drain better because we get balance of pressure there. Simple as that. We put the tubes in. If we have repeated earaches, usually the kids are like 3 years of age or 5 years of age, something like that. And then they expel them, they fall out. Sometimes we have to put them back in, but usually by age 7 or so, if they fall out, we don't worry about it. It's a little tiny thing. It doesn't result in death or anything like that. It heals over, it's not a problem. That approach, although it sounds rather strange, that approach then resolves the issue of the fluid buildup, which resolves the need for the pain, which then resolves the need for the patient to misdiagnose this as a bacterial infection and a physician to mistreat it as a bacterial infection. So we solve all the problems. So we're using tubes in the ears and we're using flu mist as a way of getting at this from two different points of view to solve the problems of earaches. And the big problem of earaches is not the earache itself, but the mistreatment in terms of the antibiotic use, misuse of antibiotics. Of acute upper respiratory tract infections are viral. Hello. So we're talking about sore throats, sinus infections, and earaches, and so on. 90% of the problem is a virus. So that means that 90% of sore throats are not treated by antibiotics or such a thing. Now, in defense of the medical community, there is a possibility of secondary bacterial infections. We just mentioned it, that if we don't treat this earache appropriately, that over a period of time, as short as maybe 7 days or so, but certainly if it goes on chronically, it can result in bacterial infection. But our primary problem, our initial problem, is viral. That's the same thing is true for bacterial infections, let's say a sore throat or a sinus infection and so on. Those infections primarily are viral. Now, the secondary bacterial infections occur in all patients equally? No. Some patients are at greater risk for secondary bacterial infection. Immunocompromised patients, for example. And we talked about the kids, the age 3 months, 5 years of age. Elderly people with cardiac problems, et cetera, those people are greater risk for secondary bacterial infection. So in defense of the medical community, if they use antibiotics at the time of the initial infection, they may be preventing some bacterial infections of a secondary nature. Okay? But that's only going to be appropriate medical prophylactic use of prophylactic now. We're not treating the infection yet, and it's not here. Secondary infection. But it's only likely to occur in immunocompromised patients. So the use of the antibiotic in those settings for sore throats and sinus infections and so on would be most likely to be a problem in an immunocompromised patient. So if you're not in an immunocompromised status, then we're back to you shouldn't use the antibiotic. Okay. The clinical implications are that patients are mistreated and we select for antibiotic resistance. The physicians and the patients believe that by the pain the patient complains of, that is, the symptoms, the patient has symptoms, they have their concern, and the signs are what the physician sees, so we have signs and symptoms that we usually abbreviate S/S, signs and symptoms. Again, the patient has
symptoms, the physician sees the signs. So the signs and symptoms, the patient and the physician feel that somehow they can look, let's say, at a sore throat and go, aha, this is the one that's the bacterial sore throat. They really can. They think they can, but they can. In blind studies, when both the doctor and the physician were blind, they don't know what's really going on when we test it. It's just a matter of guess. Oh, it's really, really red. It's a physician. It must be, or it's got white things on it. It must be bacterial. Or the patient goes, wow, it really, really hurts. It must be bacterial. Now, we do have some enzyme tests that can be done rather quickly, particularly for strep pyogenes. They'll catch most of strep pyogenes. So we can take a sample from the patient, and in a matter of minutes, come back with, yes, we do have strep. Okay. So we do have an enzyme test that will give us that one. Otherwise, we have to culture the organism. Of course, that takes a day to get the organism back. So what does it look like? Well, if you look at colds, okay, we look at common colds and infections and so on, upper respiratory tract problems. This is cases per 100 years. Cases per 100 people per year. Okay. So that means we have about 350. That means the average person gets sick 3.5 times per year. The so-called common cold. We'll talk about the common cold agents in a little bit. They're all viral. And of course, we do have occasional outbreaks of influenza, and that's one chance out of 50 chances out of 100 a year. That's pretty high. It's not even that high, but nonetheless, we'll say we got that. And then all other infectious diseases are down here. This would be bacterial, fungal, and other kinds of infections. So it's not close. It's not like, oh, well, if I treat for bacterial infection, I'm right half the time. No, you're right 10% of the time. 90% of the time, bad. All right, first we have a list of organisms here. These are viral agents, upper respiratory tract agents, and the first three on there are associated with everybody getting them. The bottom two are associated with people at risk getting them. So we have people at risk getting the bottom two. Everybody gets top three. Now, having said that, there'll be some people who say, oh, you're at risk, you only get the bottom two, you can't get the other one. No, you're at risk, you get all five. Okay. But if you're an otherwise healthy person, the top three are the ones you might get associated with the so-called common cold. There are numerous serotypes of the top three. Do not expect to see a vaccine for a common cold. Remember, your immunity is serotype specific. So if we're going to protect you with a vaccine, we have to have the serotype that we're trying to protect you against in the vaccine. Therefore, we have to have hundreds of different serotypes represented. That's not likely to occur. Rhinoviruses, coronaviruses, and adenoviruses vary in their severity and locations, where in the upper respiratory tract we see their problems. Rhinovirus, as the name suggests, is associated with the sinuses and the nasal passages. So this can give you the sniffles. Okay. So we'll have basically the nasal passages involved. Now remember, a person doesn't get pure culture. You can get lots of things at the same time. So you get the rhinovirus, and it's relatively mild. Coronavirus. Now, coronavirus can involve eustachian tubes and middle ear, sinuses, throat, and the conjunctiva of the eye. So it can be several more extensive in the areas where it has receptor sites that will match. Remember, that's what it determines our specificity here. Now, occasionally, coronavirus
that normally causes the common cold can cause some congestion. And of course, when you have congestion, then you have postnasal drip. And if you have postnasal drip, you get a sore throat. Okay. So it's a typical kind of flu, typical kind of common cold problem, sort of an upper respiratory tract head cold kind of thing. But occasionally, coronavirus can cause something else. It has an evil twin brother. We're not really sure the mechanism of the virus picking up this new characteristic, but it significantly changes its virulence. And it causes something called severe acute respiratory tract syndrome, or SARS. S-A-R-S, SARS, severe acute respiratory tract syndrome. And in SARS, it goes systemic. And we have pulmonary congestion, we have problems with the cardiovascular system in some of the patients, and it can cause death. We've had several SARS epidemics. Anybody from Canada? We had a SARS epidemic a couple years ago in Toronto. And we've learned a couple of things. One, we have to be careful about how we deal with this relative to public relations. Because as soon as people know that there's this virus that's spreading, that's causing death, now, in this setting, who do you think is at greatest risk? It's going to be the younger children, elderly people, people with cardiovascular problems already, diabetics, people's immune system isn't working well, AIDS patients, leukemia patients, and so on. But the general public gets afraid. And as soon as they develop a head cold, a postnasal drip, and sinus, and so on, immediately they think they have SARS. And so they run to the hospital because they have SARS. Well, they don't have SARS. And the people who are having difficulty breathing, they have respiratory tract problems, fluid around the lungs, they're having severe respiratory tract problems and need to be put on a respirator kind of problem. Okay? These other people got runny nose and head colds. And what happens is that they flood the emergency room. And the number of actual SARS cases versus the number of people who are walking well, so to speak, is way in favor of the number walking well. So you have to sort through 100 people or more to get a SARS patient. This takes a lot of time. And a lot of SARS patients didn't get attended to quick enough and died because they just didn't get in the right queue. They put the long line in Meijer or something. So flooding the system with well people is not a good deal. The other thing that happened is when you're waiting in this emergency room in Toronto Hospital, and there's 500 people there, and there's only a handful of people with SARS, but they're all waiting for the people that don't have SARS. They're spreading it to people who came because they never thought they were sick, and actually become sick in the hospital. They're exposed to SARS in the emergency room waiting to get treated. And so they had this kind of phenomenon, spreading amongst the sick people to the walking well. So we have a problem. In addition to the disease itself, we have a medical management problem. And we've seen this with outbreaks of bird flu when it's just come about, avian influenza. And so you can sense we're learning about this with what we're trying to do with H1N1 now. We're not telling everybody you're going to die of this kind of thing. We'll have immunizations available. There'll be lots of chances for you to get immunized and so on. This is a public relation thing as much as it is a medical thing. And important because implications are, if we don't handle it properly with a public relations angle, we will have people die because of too many people trying to get crammed into the emergency room. SARS patients died because they didn't get treated fast enough. Some people got SARS because they went to the emergency room and got into the emergency room. So it's sort of a healthcare delivery, public relations process, but it's important because it doesn't impact the disease process. So that's coronavirus. Usually, it's a head cold, but we do have these outbreaks of SARS. We're not really sure of where the virus is picking up the virulence factor. But it's one of the common trends that we see in this is that it triggers the release of cytokines, cell signals that result in pulmonary congestion, fluid in the lung, and the need for a respirator. Adenovirus. Again, adenovirus is one of those agents that can cause sore throats. A little more severe sinus infections. It causes a more severe conjunctivitis of the eye. The eye will become sort of a raspberry, like an open tomato kind of color, really red kind of color, and you can sort of peel back the eye and really, all the whites of your eye are, I'm sure they're really red. Not pink, I'm sure, but we're talking red. Really, really inflamed with adenovirus. Now again, with the immunocompromised people, they will have these more severely, as you would expect. But they can also get the other two. So we have parainfluenza virus, commonly seen in children between the ages of 3 months and 5 years of age. And we call it croup. Croup, C-R-O-U-P, croup. And it's an odd kind of cough. It's a hoop. I mean, it's almost like a whooping cough. So we have this croupy kind of cough. The kid coughs to the point where they lose their breath, and they panic, and they start turning blue. They won't die of that, but it scares them. Of course, when you have a scared three-year-old, then you have scared parents. The kid isn't breathing. So immediately they take the kid in the emergency room. Usually this occurs in the winter months of the year or early spring when it's sort of cool out and the car is cold and you take the kid into the cold car, get into the emergency room, and that cold air actually opens up the respiratory tract, and by the time you get to the emergency room, the kid is sleeping because he's all tired and talking all the time, and now he doesn't talk anymore because it's all lit up and he looks sort of silly. But he was really going to die for 20 minutes and all, now he's sleeping. But that's a typical kind of group kind of situation. We can also deal with it by increasing humidity. So you can turn on the shower in the bathroom and steam. Don't put the kid in the steam shower. But put the steam come up over the top of the shower there, or through the door or whatever, and in the bathroom, because high humidity tends to help as well. Okay? So we deal with this sort of physical needs rather than something. So that carries the respiratory syncytial virus, potentially more severe. And we'll talk about it next time.